So you can tell that Jonas is not an observer because he called. He asked me to talk about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which I'm not a member of the collaboration for, and which by itself, although a very fine and excellent experiment, is really only a small slice of like the entire world of like galaxy surveys in general. And so I decided to change the name of my lecture to Surveys, and then with the subtitle An Outsider's Perspective, to emphasize on the positive side that I have no vested interest. There's no one giving me money to study new surveys or to defend any particular data set. And also to protect me from any really incisive and deep questions that you may have that I don't have answers for. Because you heard from Pat McDonald, who is actually a Sloan collaborator on Monday, a much more detailed talk than I'll be giving. Now I'm going to give more of a broad perspective on what surveys can do and what surveys can do for you, basically. All right, so what are surveys? So you had probably some inkling of this before. So basically, a survey is just a catalog of bright objects in the sky. Typically, galaxies and quasars are what we is what astronomers survey, not me. And then you look at them all, you find them, you try to make them three-dimensional, and then you put that in an archive, which nowadays publish online for graduate students like yourselves to look up and use. And so there's two things that I'm going to focus on that you use these for. I'm actually going to focus almost exclusively on the first one, which is cosmology. In particular, the way that galaxy surveys help us to measure the same thing you've been hearing about a lot as well, which is the primordial power spectrum, the initial perturbations that grew up into being us. But I think it's important to emphasize, and as all that talk about gas physics in the last lecture should have reminded you, is that even though this is a cosmological problem, and we spend a lot of time in cosmology and like string theory thinking about things like scalar fields and gauge invariant constructions of objects and general relativity, but this is a whole lot of astrophysics out there. And particularly, the later you go in the universe, it's a good rule that the later you go and you try to in the universe and try to do cosmology, then the more you have to know about astrophysics to do it, because astrophysics gets more complicated. As time goes on, astrophysics gets more complicated. And we're going to talk very little bit about that. Only a very little bit, because I don't know much about it. But it's important that you know that there are people in the world, probably in your very own department, who know very much about this, and so it's not something you should just denigrate or forget about. Not that I'm saying you would denigrate it, but you know what I'm saying. All right, so a survey. This is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey telescope, since I'm supposed to talk about that, and that's what I'm going to mainly talk about. I thought I'd show a picture of it. It's 100 inches. Now, those of you who prefer metric will think of that as 2.5 meters, but I personally prefer Her Majesty's unit. And this is Canada, right? So the thing that you should remember about surveys is to think for a moment like an astronomer and pretend that you don't care about, well, I know that astronomers don't care about this, but pretend that your main concern is like there's bright lights very far away, and you want to see them, right? That's what stars and galaxies and quasars are. And so the astronomers talk about the depth of the survey, which basically tells how far back or how distant you can look, basically how faint of a source can you see. And then the breadth, which is like how much of the sky you cover. Because remember, if you're doing a survey, then, as we all know, the political surveys say that you can either sample a few people or a lot of people. And so for the sky, there's a big old sky out there. And if you want to look a long way, then you have to sit in one spot part of the sky for a long time. But if you want to look, but that's not very good because that may not be a representative portion of the sky. Joao was just talking about foregrounds, right? And so the sky is not up. Even though we live in a basically isotropic and homogeneous universe, the sky is not really friendly in that way. But there are some places where there's lots of stuff, and there's other places where there's not so much stuff. And you want some way to average over that by looking across with a lot of breadth. And so so there's a balance between these two considerations that you have to take into account. And so just as a side note, I would encourage, not that I see anyone taking notes, but don't worry about too much about taking notes during this lecture, because I don't have anything really like calculational to say. And probably would learn more by just listening than trying to write down. And as you'll also soon see, that most of my slides have been borrowed. I stole them from other people. And so you can also, you too can use Google and find almost all the information that I have here. Anyway, so back to the this. So there's also resolution, which is like there's how finely you can resolve the points in the sky. Because you may be able to find a lot of blotches out there, even very faint blotches. But if you don't, if you can't see what they are, then they may not be very useful to you. But the, again, if you have a higher, if you have a worry about getting higher resolution, that means you have to sit there and wait for more photons, and that means that you have to sacrifice the time you could be looking somewhere else, and thus breadth. And finally, there's another component, and this is the part that gets really hard, and that's spectroscopy. That is, you want to know the, like what kind of light is coming. Is it red light? Is it blue light? Is it X-ray? Is it infrared radiation? And the reason why you need to know this for cosmology is because, you know, the night sky sure looks two-dimensional to me when I look at it. But as we all know, it's actually three-dimensional. But there aren't little signs outside of galaxies saying, I am at redshift of 5.3. Or, you know, look at me 10 million miles away from you. All you get is light, and it's been redshifted by the expansion of the universe, and it's been dimmed by its distance from you. And so you have to put that information together. And the best, and the one thing that you definitely always need to be able to make some kind of intrinsic measurement about a distance is a redshift. And to get that, you have to have a telescope that can distinguish red from blue. And you think that that's maybe kind of an easy thing to do because our eyes do it for us. But not all telescopes can do that. And it's actually, that's a major thing that you have to be able to do. So again, I'm not an expert on this, but these are things that one needs to know. So, but lots of people thought about this and did this long digital sky survey. And so I thought I'd show this little movie that they made, because it takes up part of the time of my way too long talk. And so this is just going to be a picture of what Sloan found in the sky after it looked. So this is really what the universe looks like. These are all of those blotches are real galaxies, and they're accurately there's an accurate representation of how far they are from us, albeit on a very scaled down a lot. And so this is a computer reconstruction of what it would look like to travel at much speeds much higher than the speed of light away, but not taking into account relativity. It's sort of like Star Trek, but through the real universe. And so, but you see, what you start to see there is that there's patterns in the sky, right? There's patterns in the real distribution of galaxies up there. And it's going to start spinning here in a second. My computer doesn't stop. So this is, it's pretty amazing, actually, how much information is encoded here. 500,000 galaxies. So I just want you to pay attention to sort of this cobweb-like shape there, because we're going to come back to that in a second. And that's a true fact about our universe, that all the matter in our universe falls into these cobweb-like, these filamentary structures, these lines of higher density with the voids in between. And then, because they had to make their video relevant to the CMB, they also zoom back out and try to show that all those galaxies came from other things. They keep going, it's too long. Anyway, so that was the video. So that's supposed to give you an idea about, can we have the light spectrum? Thanks. Just because otherwise people will go to sleep. It's okay if you go to sleep, just try to make it not obvious.
Is that online anywhere?
Yeah, it is. I found it using Google somehow. I just typed in my Sloan movie. I think. I'm sorry, am I giving away all the secrets of breath research? all of your professors and supervisors do this too, they just may not convince them. Okay, and so here's the boring and technical version of what I just showed you, which is just a distribution of the things the Sloan Digital Sky Survey sees. And so you got sort of the nearby stuff up there, and you see it's pretty dense because you can see things that are closer better. And then there's these so-called luminous red galaxies out here, which are confusingly plotted in blue, even though they look red. Anyway, and so you see there's a lot of them out here, and there's this green stuff in the middle. And the green stuff in the middle is the other major survey that JOMA doesn't want you to know about. Not really, but it's called the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. And it's interesting because it was older, it was done before Sloan, and it sort of looked in the region between the Sloan's galaxy survey, which is close by, the red stuff, and Sloan's luminous red galaxy survey, which is the faraway stuff. And so it's kind of useful to remember that there's another data set. It's not just this Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So you're never going to hear, whenever you go to conferences, you're going to see a lot of people like Pat McDonald who work on Sloan talk about Sloan. But it's good to remember that there is another data set out there. Just because people work hard on it and it's tell you things. I don't really want to say too much about all of the details of this, but the Luminosphere galaxies are kind of interesting beasts. It's just they're very distant galaxies that we call luminous because you can see them far away away, that means they're bright, and they look red because they're a long way away and they've been registered. So they're pretty important for cosmology, for doing cosmology. Anyway, so what was left out of that were quasars, which you heard about from Pat. And the reason why anybody ever talks about quasars is, well, there's two things. There's sort of intrinsic astrophysical interest to quasars. Yeah?
In both previous slides?
Yep.
Those that the further away you go, it's less as well. I would expect a larger scale forest.
Do you mean locally or?
No, you're saying this as you go far away, you have.
Oh, these strips? These are just places they didn't look.
Huh?
These blank strips here? These are places they didn't look. And right and way out here, this is very far away. And so you're only seeing the very brightest things. This is another aspect that I glossed over when you're designing a survey, is that you're going to be something called, you're going to be limited by how bright of the light you can see, right? And so the depth of that survey, you might say that the proper depth is like something like this, and you're going to see everything up to that point. But there's going to be bright stuff behind that point that you're also going to see. And you're going to know that it's behind that point, and now you have to think about what you want to do with that information. Because you guess that there's a lot of dim stuff out here that you just can't see because it's too far away. But you don't actually know that. It could be that our universe is weird, and at some point, all of the dim stuff turns off, and there's only bright light. But we don't really expect that, right? So no, it's not. It's all the same. But this is a long time ago, so the character of space, I mean, the character of correlations was different. Things were less small. And we're going to kind of go into that maybe a little bit later. Does that make sense?
Yes. But I was just worrying about, some of the universe are sketches as appropriate. See, it tells that in this picture it doesn't.
Right, well, I mean, okay, unless you have Fourier eyes, I don't think you can really tell me much about the isotropy here, because this is a plot of points on a red shirt versus red ascension plot. And, I mean, maybe you're a super expert on analyzing. I'm not. But I could never look at this and tell you whether this is isotropic or not. And I just don't think it can be done. And I know it looks kind of anisotropic, but I think that this may be an artifact of the way it's being plotted. So don't worry, is what I'm saying. Unless you know more than I do, in which case you can go worry and write a paper. Okay, so quasars are cool by themselves because most people think that quasars are active galactic nuclei, so big balls of stuff falling onto galaxies far, far away, which are intrinsically an interesting thing. But for cosmologists, quasars are mainly interesting because they're really old and they're far away, which is the same. Is really saying the same thing. And they're bright enough to see, and so they're backlighting for the Lyman Alpha clouds, which Pat talked about a lot on Monday. And they basically backlighting for everything. They're behind everything else in the sky almost. And so anytime you want to have some theory about what happens to light as it goes from very far to now. Then you're going to want to know a little bit about quasars, because quasars are going to provide you little point sources very, very far away that you can say, well, if I think that all my photons will change into axions over a time period of a billion years. So you have a theory like that. Then you're going to have to go deal with the fact that we have to think about quasars, because quasars are farther than a billion years away. Their light has been traveling more than 1 billion years. And so if you have a theory about what light does over long, long periods of time, then you can look at something like a quasar that's so far away that it's actually sampled all that, and you have to and try to learn about your theory of that. But then the other thing that we mainly look at, and the main focus of this talk, is going to be galaxies, and we look at galaxies because they're big and they're bright and they trace dark matter. And by big and bright, I mean that they're big enough to resolve. You can actually tell what it is. Galaxies look like splotches on the sky, not like dots. And that turns out that's actually kind of an important distinction. Because you know it's a galaxy and you can actually measure things about it. It's not just a literal single pixel on your CCD. And they're bright enough to see at very great distances, because there's a lot of stars together, right? And they trace dark matter because we believe that most of the universe is dark matter, right? And we also believe that this dark matter clumps up, which is why we call it cold dark matter usually in our modern model. And whenever the dark matter clumps, the regular matter falls in too and makes galaxies like we think of, just stars and planets and stuff. And so, but since you can see galaxies, then they allow you to find the places where the dark matter fell. Because, I mean, if you had, because you could certainly imagine a scenario where there's big blotches of dark matter zooming around, and you'll never see it directly, because there's nothing to make light there. It's dark matter, right? But if it makes galaxies, then you can see those. So that's all I have to say about that. And they also clump up into clusters, which are just big collections of galaxies. Okay, but the point of galaxies, not the point of galaxies, but something that's necessary to say about galaxies is that you've just heard lots of talks about the CMB, which is, the CMB is great, it's wonderful, but it's just not the same as galaxies. Because remember, at the redshift of 1000, whenever the CMB light was made, that up to order 10 to the minus 4, this is what this galaxy. It was just one big, bright backdrop. There's no structure, nothing interesting there. But fast forward a few hundred expansion times, and all of the very tiny variations that were in the CMB had turned into not-so-tiny variations of this filamentary structure I was telling you about. So this is the large-scale structure that galaxies. And so as time goes on, the structure develops and grows and forms clusters, and then those clusters form galaxies and then stars, planets. So the point here is that when we look out now, we see things in the region of these three redshifts. And so if we're going to try to infer what the primordial power spectrum was like back here from the things we measure, say, now, you have to take into account the fact that gravity has had a long time to work on all of your matter, right? So that's a very relevant thing to say. And so I have a movie about that. So this is actually a computer simulation of taking basically a CMB like ours and running it forward until you have galaxies. And so I just wanted you to look at this to see, this is basically if we could have a complete map of what this guy looks like. This is what we think it would look like. And the main thing I want you to notice here is, as I close in, is that over this part of the sky over here doesn't look like it's correlated with this part of the sky over here, right? There's structures here, but they're confined to a particular length scale, which is going to be obvious as we zoom in here. And there's a reason for that. It's not that gravity has a limited range of efficacy, because gravity is what's causing these correlation length scales to form. Because you start with an almost homogeneous gap, and then gravity works in the slight overdensity and makes things clump up. But the universe only has a finite age, right? Maybe I can just let you watch this and I'll talk. So these are simulations done by people in Germany who have very large computers and lots of time. That's not been as exciting as Germany. It's just true. And so it's pretty amazing that they can actually do this. But it says, this actually does have relevance to the observing the clusters, because you have to be able to, by doing these kind of simulations, you can test your ideas about how to turn observations of galaxies that have had gravity work on them for a long time into statements about the primordial power structure. That's it. That's a guy, Wolfer Sprengel. You can send fan mail to him. The point here, and this is the one problem I thought of that I could assign to you came from, is that so the universe is a finite age, and so that gives a finite amount of time for gravity to start working ever since. So if anyone who has had a cosmology class, but those who don't know, the clumping of matter only started whenever matter started to dominate the cosmology. And the reason for that is because then the universe's expansion rate decreased as compared to the era whenever radiation dominated. And so that basically allowed overdensities to start clumping as opposed to just being expanded with the universe. And so those clumps, so there was a time, not like a snap, but there was a time, a period, whenever the clumps started to grow and to fall in. And so there's been only a finite amount of time between then and now. And so there's only a finite amount of time for matter to fall in on itself from that time. And so you might think that that's the relevant time scale from matter radiation, matter domination until now. That would, and then you could just kind of figure out some kind of nonlinear function. And that would be how big these structures would be, because that's how much time you've had for matter to sort of like find each other using gravity. But that's not true, because matter still doesn't dominate the universe anymore. As we all know, it's actually something like a cosmological constant or dark energy that's dominating the universe now. And dark energy has the property that it's making the universe accelerate in its expansion. And that means that matter is not falling together anymore. It's stopped. It cut off structure formation. That is, the gravity doesn't win anymore. Now, the cosmological constant, or dark energy, is winning. So if you have a fixed-size glass cloud that's being dominated not by non-linear gravitational effects, but linear, the first-order gravitational effects, then those gas clouds are no longer growing. They're actually getting pulled apart by the operation of this scalar field or cosmological constant or whatever strange gravity thing. And so the problem I want you to think about for the group activity tomorrow, and I can't remember if I know how to do this myself, but I think so, is that you can estimate how big the structures would be now if we didn't have dark energy. And you can compare that to how big the structures really are. And you can use that to say that even if you didn't know anything else about supernovae, you couldn't do fine-tuned measurements of the CMB, if you knew how big the typical scale of structure was, you could have a first crack at figuring out whether or not matter has always dominated. And if you could think about how you might estimate that basically how big the difference between the clustering size in our universe versus the clustering size in the universe without dark energy would be great. It may be too hard, and so if that's the case, then I probably won't figure out how to do it either. And we can all just talk about how ignorant we feel tomorrow, and you can ask me questions. Anyway, so pressing on, I am going to give you a break. I know that I'm not supposed to, and you have coffee breaks, but frankly, an hour and a half is too long for me. So in about 20 minutes, I'm going to give you a little 5-minute break to stretch your legs and stuff and ask me questions. So I just wanted to tell you that so you can have that look forward. Anyway, so cosmology. So I talked about the dirty work of surveys up to this point. So we're using them for cosmology. And this is a part of this is a summer school on several things, including cosmology, not on astrophysics. So the reason why structure helps us and can teach us things, and it can teach us about the following things. I can't express myself. So it teaches us about dark matter. So as I was alluding to before, dark matter forms structure. And so if you can find structure, you can find out about dark matter. And then you can also find out about baryons, because, again, you're seeing the light that comes from baryons. And again, this is Joao's was telling you about the definition of baryons for cosmologists is everything that's normal matter that we have seen. And it also has baryons can give you bumpiness in the primordial plasma that we're going to talk about a little bit. You also can learn about neutrinos because, as it turns out, neutrinos, even though nobody believes that they're the dark matter anymore, we know there are neutrinos around, and thanks to solar neutrino measurements, we know that neutrinos have some mass, right? And so it turns out that the best way to directly measure or limit the mass on the actual mass of the neutrinos, not just the difference that you get from solar neutrino measurements. Maybe you don't know you can get differences from solar neutrino measurements, but you can. The best way to measure it is to actually look at structure formation, because the funny thing about neutrinos is that since they're so light, if you have a substantial amount of neutrinos in a gas cloud, then basically, so you have a gas cloud and you have a bunch of neutrinos in it. All of these neutrinos want to move basically near the speed of light. So they run away from your gas cloud. And basically, by running away from your gas cloud, they carry matter out. And so if you have a gas cloud that's continually losing matter, it's not going to clump up very well. And so basically, if you have neutrinos that are heavy enough to make up an appreciable fraction of the mass of any gas cloud, then basically on the scale that they can stream away, they'll erase any ability to form clumpiness on those scales. And so that's why you can get measurements on neutrinos, something that you think of as a particle physics phenomenon, by measuring, like counting up how many galaxies there are in this night sky. And then as I was already saying, by looking at when structure formation stops, you can get an idea about dark. Two more things. Inflation, which you've been hearing about a lot too. You can learn a little bit about the inflationary primordial spectrum from galaxies, because it gives you another measurement of the primordial power spectrum, which I'm going to go into in a minute. And then also indirectly on the Hubble parameter, which is the current expansion rate of the universe, which you actually do have to measure. None of the equations actually give it to you. It's another parameter that has to be measured. So let me just show you what this data look like. Once you take all of those galaxies in that movie, the first movie, not the second movie, and you put them into a power spectrum plot, it looks something like this. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey galaxies look like this. You can ignore that text for a bit. This is, again, a stolen slide, and so I didn't feel like I could delete things that somebody else wrote and honestly claim it was from him, but you can ignore it. And so this is the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. As you can see, it's sort of and this is an important thing for you to know about galaxy redshift surveys. You see how these lines don't match up? At first glance, most normal people would say, uh-oh. You know, if you're supposed to be measuring the same thing, how the heck come your lines are like very distantly off from each other? Turns out this doesn't worry anybody, because there's something called a bias parameter that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. It's basically the overall location where you say to put your one fiducial point and then scale everything up to that point is a totally free parameter for these models. It's not very well understood how you sort of normalize the total power. All you can do is contrast power on different scales. And so this may seem like a problem to you. It seems like a problem to me, but it doesn't seem to worry anybody else. So. And they know more than I do, so maybe we shouldn't worry. But it's something you should know, is that always, whenever you do these experiments, you just have to, at the end of the day, like you calculate the shape and everything, and then you say, and we move it up this much to match our data. I kid you not, that's all you do. Anyway, so the point here is to say that the Sloan Digital Sky Survey looks on smaller scales. So these are smaller distances, these are closer to us. And see, this in two-degree field doesn't have as many galaxies. So maybe exaggerating the various bars a bit, but it has more data points out here at further scale. So I just thought I should be fair to them. And again, this is just saying the same thing, that you look at the power spectrum, like this is the power spectrum you infer from WMAP data, and then you just keep on going, then you get the 2-degree field data. And then by contrast, so all these points are at about 0.1 over here for Sloan. At 0.1 you don't have much, but you have a bunch over here at smaller scale. Again, you've seen this big picture slide before. And so the thing I wanted to remind you about on this slide is that up here at the smaller scales where SDSS is the density contrast is going up. So remember, whenever I was doing these calculations with CMB, the density contrast is like, you know, it's down here. This is the CMB, it's like here. And so this is whenever you can ignore gravity as a small effect, which is always nice. But whenever you get up to density contrast of order 1, then gravity is no longer a small effect, obviously. And so that is what complicates all of the measurements you do here. So you may well wonder, how come you do these measurements all then? Why don't you just stick with the CMB? And there are reasons for that. The main reason is basically that it provides a check. I mean, the CMB is great and everything, but if I wanted to bet on what the cosmological parameters were, I'd feel a little bit more comfortable if I knew that there was some other measurement that would give me a confirming data, that it's not just the CMB, because maybe we just misunderstood something about the CMB. But it also actually improves your measurement. And so here's the CMB map. This is actually from WMAP 1, but it's that's not really relevant here. And so this is basically what the Sloan Digital Sky Survey galaxy, the regular galaxy power structure looks like. And so if you just look at the CMB data, then you can put error bars kind of like that on these lines. And from the, like, these are like 2 sigma, and then you get like 1 sigma error bar. And then you can get, well, I can't remember, maybe this is 3, 2, 1 sigma. Sorry. And then if you add on the galaxy data, then basically you sort of squeeze things down just a little bit more. So they make a marginal but real improvement to how well you can measure all these cosmological parameters. And that's summarized here. So basically the yellow lines, the yellow and orange are what you get from the CMB by itself. And from the Sloan Digital Sky Surveys, you get the red curves. And so I just realized that I haven't explained what these are. So these are what are known as marginalized posterior distribution functions. You should probably know what these are. Some of you may know. Basically, that over here is a arbitrary measure of something like probability. And these are, and along the x-axis are different values for the actual parameters being measured. And so basically what these are giving is the location of the probability of the probability taking that value given the data that you have. It's sort of a Bayesian way of looking at things. If you don't know what that is, I'm not going to explain it to you now. And so basically the more highly peaked or tightly peaked this distribution is, the more confidence you have that you've measured that parameter to have that value in our universe. And it's important to say this because people say things like, the Hubble constant, WMAP bound n sub s equals 0.95. You know, you hear people say that sort of thing. Maybe you haven't heard that yet, but if you stay in physics long, you're going to start hearing that a lot. And that's not, strictly speaking, true. What they found, strictly speaking, is WMAP found that given a model for the power spectrum, wherein you write the power spectrum as a function that looks like this, then you found that the data would be fit well by this model if you put for that parameter something in this range. And that the closer you get to the peak, the better the fit for your model, given that model and your data. So that's really what you're saying. Now, because we have confidence that we've learned a lot about physics, that we think that this has done something real. But you can very well write down completely phony models that have nothing to do with reality, that you can cook up to fit those data points. And you can make a plot that looks just like this and have very impressive measurements of imaginary parameters. And so I think it's always important to emphasize that the data are always standing behind there, and they have error bars, and there's systematic fix, and all kinds of stuff going on there. So I just wanted to do that. Okay, so the point here is that there's a few things here that the Sloan data have really improved on. Like, you can see that there's a tightening here in sigma 8, which is basically how clumpy matter is nowadays. And you can see there's a very much better measurement on B, and that's because B is this bias parameter I was telling you about, just the arbitrary moving up and down of the power. So obviously, WMAP's not going to measure that. And the interesting ones are things like where the peak for WMAP and the Sloan data disagree, like for the spectral index. You see that Sloan actually prefers a different value from WMAP. Or for the baryon density, Sloan prefers a different value from WMAP. So these are the sorts of things that you can learn by comparing data sets. Or also for the neutrino fraction. I'm gonna go into these a little bit more detail. Okay, I already made fun of the bias, so I can just skip this. So basically, just to give you some idea of how this works, I'm going to go through a series of slides made by Max Tegmark before the break, and show you how basically these parameters are determined by adding up different observations. So this is the Hubble parameter H, it's the current rate of expansion of the universe, and the how much matter is in the universe. And so because we have the Hubble Space Telescope, which the first name of which tells you why it was built, it wasn't built to make pretty pictures. It was actually built to measure the current rate of expansion in the universe. And that did very well. It gives you this bar, this area, where we think that that has to fall. And so then you add WMAP 1, and you get that allowed region in your primary space. And you did WMAP 3, and you got that allowed region. And then you add the galaxies, and you find that you've really nailed a little region where you're allowed to sit in the space of matter density versus Hubble frame. And so you can see that the slowing doesn't change things that much. You did pretty well with just WMAP. But doing the galaxy surveys not only confirms what WMAP found, but it also improves on it a little bit. And so this is a little movie. I know you saw all of these with Joel, so you just have to bear with me because I didn't know he was going to do that at all when I was preparing this. But the point here, basically, is just this is a slightly different one from the one he showed. Is that it's supposed to be showing how, as you change the dark matter density, how this power spectrum shape changes. You can ignore the CMB for now. So we're talking about galaxies here. And you can see that it's also changing the Hubble rate because they're trying to keep this point fixed. And that's also set by H. And so you can see that as you add more dark matter, then the amount of power on all scales, on these very large scales, gets bigger. Because basically there's just more matter around the compound. And so that's why you can get a measurement on the total power from these data points. Okay? So then you can also get the flatness in very much the same way. And I can go through that because Joel talked about it very nicely. You can also get the age of the universe, which, even though that doesn't seem like a thing that, you know, it's not like a prediction of theories, it's still, lots of people like to know how old the universe is, and it's kind of cool that, it's really nice, actually, to see that, finally, the preferred value from cosmological experiments is greater than the ages of the oldest stars, which any of you know who know your cosmological history know has not been the case for very long. For most of the cosmological modern era, i.e. since Einstein, the preferred value was somewhere in here. So, still fodder for crazy people with pitches. You can find, not to make some crank. Okay, so you can also find out things about the dark energy. Basically, without even using supernovae, you can make limitations on what the dark energy equation of state is. Again, this is that effect from the cutoff spectra I was telling you about. And the reason you can do this, and another movie, is that you can see that basically as dark energy, you can see this cutoff happen, that as dark energy changes, then you change the power. Anyway, you change the shape of the power. So here again, this is more of a direct measurement of inflation. Sorry. So again, here you see what Will Kenney was talking about the pi to the fourth inflationary theory being sort of disfavored. It's not as bad as I think he was saying, but basically, it's just the more data you get here, the better you measure this spectral index. And so then you can really make measurements in this space that can eliminate inflationary theories and make sharp predictions for things like that. Again, this is just all emphasizing that the Sloan actually does change things. And again, I just want to emphasize that what this spectral index means as a modeling parameter, that even though you think it's just some number that comes out of an inflationary model, it really is just it's the pivot arm here. It helps you relate small scale to large scale structures. And we're going to talk more about what that means for doing experiments in a little while. And then the other thing I want to emphasize, besides spectral index, which I'm going to come back to, are neutrinos, which I talked about a little bit. And so you can get all these limits on neutrinos from the CMB, basically for this reason. But you also get a pretty good improvement from Sloan, basically for the same reason, because the more you measure small-scale structure, and the more you find out that the small-scale structure is not being destroyed, then the sharper the limit you can get on the masses of neutrinos. Again, so you can see this structure getting basically damped away by neutrinos. run the preview one more time. Okay, so yeah, you see as the neutrinos go up, the power on those scales goes down. And then one last thing before our break is basically I just want to give you some sense of the, there's a lot of data that goes into this. I was talking about all those luminous red galaxies and the regular galaxies. Is that if you just do an analysis where you just take a small subset of those galaxies and you want to find out, you know, how much of the statistical work or one set of galaxies, of course, the Sloan people being very thorough, did this and just said, well, let's just take this subset. Well, let's take this subset. And you can get all of these different measurements on, in, say, this parameter space. And you see that you really do get pretty consistent measurements from all the different sub-data sets. And then when you combine them all, and then combine them with WMAP, which is the yellow bin out here, then that's where you get this tight error bar that I showed in the previous slide. OK, so you can find more movies on Beck Framework's webpage. And I'm going to now give you a 5-minute break. I'll start precisely at 11:50 on that clock. So if any of you want to ask questions, you can come up and ask questions now. Otherwise, you know, stand up, stretch, go to the bathroom. Thank you.